This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that Republican Scott Brown has been elected to fill Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, the Democrats no longer have the 60 seats in the Senate they need to override a filibuster. That could kill the health care bill. The threat of filibuster has been looming over the proceedings of the Senate all year. But today on Good Morning America, Ed Rendell, the governor of Pennsylvania, said, quote, make them filibuster. Make the American people look at a modern-day spectacle of what a filibuster would entail, unquote. Democratic Senator Tom Harkin would like to reform the filibuster rules of the Senate so that eventually a simple majority vote could pass legislation. During the George W. Bush presidency, when Democrats were in the minority in the Senate, they used the threat of filibuster to block some of Bush's judicial nominees. So with all this controversy over the use of the filibuster, we're going to take a look at how the filibuster was created and how it's functioned over time. My guest is Greg Koger, the author of the forthcoming book, Going to the Mattresses, The History of Filibustering in Congress. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Miami. Greg Koger, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we get into what's happening politically now, I'm just going to start with the very basics. Tell us what we mean now by a filibuster and what you need to get a filibuster to end.
Right now, a filibuster means that some senator or group of senators will not allow the Senate to set a time for voting on a bill or nomination. And what they are threatening is that they will speak forever, although they won't actually be forced to speak forever. And the way that majorities in the Senate typically respond to that is by filing for a cloture petition. And it takes 60 votes to successfully invoke cloture. And what that does is it limits debate on a bill or nomination to 30 hours.
The impression many people have now is that the filibuster is being used by Republicans to block just about any piece of legislation that the Democrats are trying to pass. Having studied the history of the filibuster, do you think that the filibuster is being used more frequently now and for more reasons now than has ever historically been true before?
Well, over the last 20 years, we sort of reached a very high plateau for filibustering, in which any senator feels comfortable threatening to filibuster legislation or nomination. And since the minority party is usually more than 40 holds more than 40 seats in the Senate, that usually means that if they stick together, they can block any piece of legislation. So what's changed over the last, say, 10 years is just is the combination of the system that allows filibustering to occur quite easily and the polarization of the two American political parties, so that it's much more likely that the minority party can stick together on these cloture votes and that they might do so for strategic reasons.
Most people think of the filibuster as the classic filibuster where somebody's just making a long-winded speech endlessly or reading from the phone book or just like reading from anything in general just to keep the filibuster going. Nowadays, filibusters are just the threat of a filibuster. You don't see senators on the floor actually making endless speeches. It's just the threat of having enough votes to prevent cloture. Why is that? Everybody wants to know, why don't the Democrats, when they're threatened with a filibuster, why don't they insist, oh yeah, well, go ahead and make speeches for days and days and days. Go ahead.
Well, you're right. It used to be that way. Up until the early 1960s. And what basically happened is that senators realized that it was very difficult to actually wait out a filibuster. And at the same time that the other things they could be doing with their time were very valuable to them. They could be flying back home or holding fundraisers or working in committee. And so there was a sort of collective decision that they weren't going to try to fight these old style battles anymore, that they would file what's known as a cloture petition. And if they had the votes, they'd win. If they didn't have the votes, they'd lose. But they'd live with that and they wouldn't try to wait out a filibuster.
If the Democrats, who are the majority party now, did insist that they wanted the Republicans to do the full-fledged filibuster, do the whole theater of it, what would that mean for the Republicans? What would they have to do?
They would have to continuously occupy the floor of the Senate. At least one person would have to be there speaking or making motions at all times. Now, that actually wouldn't be that difficult for them on, say, healthcare bill, because there's, you know, now 41 of them, and many of them are very passionate opponents of this bill. And so they'd probably enjoy standing up and speaking for 4 to 6 hours against it.
So also, you know, an answer to the people who say, how come the Democrats now aren't like getting the Republicans to do the full blown theater of filibuster? You say one of the reasons why is the quorum call, that the Republican, the lone Republican in the chamber who's doing the filibuster, can at any time do a quorum call. What does that mean? And what would the implications of that be in the middle of a filibuster?
Right. The Constitution says that a majority shall constitute a quorum of either chamber. And what that means is that at any point in time, if a legislature is trying to do something, there has to be at least half the membership there and present and ready to legislate. So what that means in the context of a filibuster is that if somebody is speaking, and then what they can do is they note the absence of a quorum, which means I don't think there's really a majority of the Senate here, which is probably true, because on any given day, there's very few people actually sitting in the Senate chamber. So if there's a filibuster going on and a senator notes the absence of a quorum, what that means is that the supporters of the bill, the people who are fighting the filibuster, have to prove that there is a majority of the chamber there. And so they have to, you know, they would have to be in the chamber. They flood in the chamber from, you know, maybe they're sitting right outside, and prove that there is in fact a majority of the chamber ready to do business. And if there isn't a majority ready to do business, then the whole chamber just sort of comes to a screeching halt, and it just sits there, empty, well, doing nothing, until, the supporters of the bill actually do bring in a majority of the chamber and prove that it's ready to do business.
But it's kind of doing nothing anyways during the filibuster. So what's the difference between doing nothing because it's shut down and doing nothing because there's a filibuster occupying all the time?
Well, at least in theory, if somebody is standing and speaking, that's doing something. Whereas if there's no quorum, then doing nothing means literally they just sit and look at each other and say, well, I wish there were more people here. And the only thing they can accomplish at that point is to just go home to adjourn, or they can ask the sergeant at arms to bring in some of the missing senators. There's a famous case of this in 1988 when Robert Byrd, the majority leader, he's trying for really the last real time to have a live filibuster and actually make, in this case, the Republicans conduct a live filibuster against campaign finance reform. So Byrd moved to have the sergeant-at-arms bring in missing senators, and the sergeant-at-arms then went up to Bob Packwood's office. He's a Republican from Oregon. Packwood had like blocked the door of his office and put a desk there to keep the sergeant-at-arms out. So the sergeant-at-arms gets some aid and forces the door open. In doing so, he sort of injures Packwood's arm. And then they literally carry him like a protester to the Senate chamber and say, here's one of the missing senators.
Do you think filibustering was a different kind of tactic before politics was as polarized as it is today, where parties and probably particularly the Republican Party tends to vote in a block? There seems to be much less bipartisanship than in other eras. So has that made filibustering into a different animal?
In some ways, yes. I mean, in my writing, I've defended the filibuster because it does promote, you know, compromise and bipartisanship and moderation. And in the long run, I think these are good things. But faced with a minority party that seems completely unified, and partially that's for strategic reasons, it seems difficult, we'll say, to have a set of rules that promote bipartisanship. They're intended to thrive in an environment of bipartisanship and compromise when, you know, it's very difficult to get any member of the minority party to engage in a conversation. So yeah, I mean, there does seem to be, we'll say, a mismatch between the existing Senate rules and the behavior of the minority party in the current Senate. Although, I mean, to be fair, the Republicans would suggest that the Democrats have not gone as far as they could have to reach out.
To reach out across the aisle and make compromises.
That's right.
You know, the Constitution says that in the Senate it should take a simple majority to pass legislation. And nowadays, like right now, it seems to take 60 votes to pass any legislation instead of 51, because 60 is what you need for a cloture. And some people are raising the question, have we gotten to the point where the Senate is operating in a way that's unconstitutional, since the Senate says that unless it's a treaty, impeachment, expulsion from office, or a constitutional amendment, it should be just a simple majority. So I wonder what you'd respond to on that. What you'd respond on that?
Well, I think the key phrase of the Constitution is from Article 1. It says that each house may determine the rules of its proceedings. And the Senate has the rules that it has on some level because this is the way they want to do business. And so that makes – to me, that makes it constitutional. And so it's hard to say that, you know, the Senate is unconstitutional. I mean, but what you can – say instead is that, you know, that because of the combination of the Senate filibuster and, you know, the polarization of parties, that there is more stability in the legislative system than the authors of the Constitution ever intended there to be, that it's so much harder to get anything done than ever intended.
Are there ways that the majority party can get around the minority party when the minority party is filibustering? Like, are there tools in this case that the Democrats could use that they haven't used?
Definitely, yes. The central theme is that the rules of the Senate are interpreted by a majority of the Senate. And that includes the possibilities of just suggesting that there's some constitutional mandate or obligation which trumps the letter of the Senate rules. Any strategy would probably take advantage of that idea. My favorite example, because it's relatively simple, is that the one Senate rule provides for a motion to suspend the rules, which is exactly what it sounds like. It says – it means that no matter what the rules say, that it's inconvenient to follow them because I want to do this one thing. And that one thing could be setting a date and a time to actually vote on, say, healthcare reform. And so you can suspend the rules to do that.
Wait a minute. Would you need 60 votes to suspend the rules?
No. What you do need is a two-thirds supermajority. But the letter of the rule doesn't say that. And so by implication, the proper interpretation of the rules is it takes a simple majority. Back in 1915, ironically, a majority of the Senate decided that it takes a two-thirds majority to suspend the rules. But that's just an interpretation and I think just a defiance of what the rule actually says. So you could restore the proper interpretation of that rule and suspend the rules by simple majority vote. The other thing that senators would have to do is enact a second precedent, an interpretation, saying that a motion to suspend the rules cannot itself be filibustered, as the House has done in the past. The combination of those things, preventing obstruction of a motion to suspend the rules and restoring the threshold to a simple majority, would give the majority party or majority faction of the Senate a parliamentary device that it could use to prevent a filibuster on a bill.
So then the filibuster would be nullified anytime there was a simple majority to bypass a filibuster.
That's right.
Any other insider technical ways that a majority party has of getting around a minority party's filibuster?
Yeah, I mean, historically, one way to get around some of the difficulties that legislators have with the rules is to assert that there is a constitutional mandate which overrides a letter of the rules. So if the majority party lost a cloture vote on something that they consider to be very important, then they could simply raise a point of order and say, actually, it takes a majority to invoke cloture on legislation. And that's not the letter of the Senate rules, but our mandate to govern overrides the letter of the Senate rules. And so from this point forward, because we have this constitutional mandate, it only takes a simple majority to invoke cloture.
I don't understand how you could just say that, though. You just say, well, we're reinterpreting well, this and we're going to change it.
Well, the trick is to not think of this as law. I mean, we use some of the vocabulary of law, like precedents and rules and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's politics. These are politicians. They have to get reelected, and they're supposed to be governing us. And that's the underlying thing. I mean, the rules are there to help politicians govern this country. And if the rules are getting in the way, then it is the prerogative, some might even say the mandate of politicians to reinterpret the rules so that they can govern effectively.
But that can't be easy to just say, we're the majority party, so we're going to reinterpret the rules now because we have a mandate.
The constraint on politicians' ability to do that is politics. If they go back to – if the majority party did that and then they went back to their constituents and said, here's what I did, and they said, really? That's a transformation of the way we thought the political system worked, and I'm outraged. Well, then they'd pay a heavy political price for that. And so if Democrats are confident in what they're doing and they believe that they have a mandate to follow through on it, then they could take the risk of, you know, imposing a new interpretation of how the Senate ought to work. But that is a risk. I mean, and it would be a political risk that they might lose elections and be discredited because of it.
Now, Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa wants to change the filibuster rules. How does he want to change them?
What he wants to do is enact a new rule that the threshold for cloture decreases by 3 votes every time you vote on a particular proposal. So say there's a bill, a health care bill on the floor, and the first vote to impose cloture on it fails because there isn't 60 votes. Well, then the second time you vote on the same issue, it'd be 57, then 54, then 51. Harkin proposed the same thing back in 1995 with Joe Lieberman as his co-sponsor.
So the logic of this is that eventually, over time, if there's 51 votes, if there's just like a majority of votes, then you can actually vote on the bill.
That is the intent of the rule. I mean, my personal opinion is that it's a really misguided proposal because it doesn't take seriously how senators will behave if the rule is adopted. If I was a senator and the rule was adopted and I was, say, in the minority, I would just filibuster everything. The approval of the journal in the morning, every bill to rename post offices, the motion to adjourn at night, filibuster everything and force them to vote on everything. And that would be so annoying and take up so much time that eventually the majority would come around and negotiate with me to stop tying up the Senate, even if, in theory, a majority could shut me up.
Although right now it's the Democrats who are the targets of filibusters, there are leading Democrats who are against changing the filibuster rules, including the Senate leader, Harry Reid. So what are their arguments against ending the filibuster, even though right now they're the targets of it?
Right. A lot of my research has been about on this question. I mean, what is it that if the senators can change the rules, why haven't they done so in the past? And I mean, to summarize, the three main benefits I think they get out of it is that there is, you know, when legislation does pass, it does tend to be moderate and bipartisan. And in particular, what that means is that you don't have one faction of the majority party that is able to, you know, convince or coerce or threaten the rest of the majority party into passing legislation that privately many of them oppose. A second thing is that, as I mentioned earlier, that the ability of the minority party to filibuster does help guarantee some degree of deliberation in the Senate. And I just mean, you know, the ability to give speeches and offer amendments. And for senators, I think there's some institutional pride in that. I mean, they watch the legislation going through the House and it's just ramrodded through. And they can take some pride in the fact that in the Senate, you actually get to debate and think about some of these things before you vote on them. And the third thing is that as individuals, senators gain a lot from the system because they can have a lot of influence on the things that they care about that few other people care about. They can block a nomination of somebody that they really despise. They can force the Senate to vote on some amendment that's mostly important to them. And so as entrepreneurs, they're much more successful and influential because there's a system that gives a lot of power to every member of the legislature.
Greg Coger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Greg Coger is the author of the forthcoming book, Going to the Mattresses, The History of Filibustering in Congress. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Miami. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The atomic bomb altered American history down to its deepest constitutional roots, writes my guest, historian Gary Wills. He says the bomb redefined the presidency, expanded executive power, and redefined the government as a national security state with an apparatus of secrecy and executive control. Gary Wills' new book is called Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. The book follows the expansion of executive power through the George W. Bush presidency and examines the early days of the Obama administration. Wills is also the author of Lincoln at Gettysburg. He's a professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University and is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books. Gary Wills, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you start thinking about ways in which the atomic bomb redefined and expanded the powers of the president?
A friend of mine grew up at Los Alamos. She was a girl my age, cut off from her friends, from comic books, from all those things. So I was aware of what a strange operation that was, where people were brought in secretly, took pseudonyms, were cut off from everything. And an amazing secrecy prevailed over 80 locales. You know, Los Alamos was not the only place. Hanford.
You should explain what Los Alamos is for people who don't know the name.
Los Alamos is where they finally put the bomb together. But Hanford and Oak Ridge were other places where uranium was processed and other processes went on. They had, as I say, 80 various locales working on this huge project with thousands of people involved and all of the world's leading physicists, except for the ones within the German domain. And they were all brought in secretly. Nobody knew where they were, how they got there. It was amazing that they kept the secret from the ones that they worried about, namely the Germans and the Japanese. They didn't keep it from the Russians because they were our allies, and they had people sympathetic with them at Los Alamos and other places. So there were leaks out, but not to the people that they were really worried about.
So you knew a girl who grew up in Los Alamos and lived in that kind of secrecy?
That's right. And she didn't know what her father was doing. He was a famous physicist. And she asked her mother later if she knew, and she didn't know. They were so good at keeping the secret. When they finished the day, they locked up all their papers. They erased all the billboards. They never referred to the bomb. They called it a gadget. They didn't call themselves physicists. It was an extraordinary discipline.
Now, you make the case in your book, Bomb Power, that Los Alamos, the whole Manhattan Project, basically became a model for covert activities in the United States.
That's right. What they had was an autocratic director, General Groves, and he had almost infinite power over these famous people that he had gathered. He spied on them. He ordered them to do this, to do that. He had his own little Air Force. He had his own intelligence service abroad. He considered assassinations of Native Americans and foreign nationals. It was an extraordinary, it was all secretly funded. Congress had no idea where all this money was going. Harry Truman, who was investigating money corruption during World War II, didn't know what was going on. In fact, he became vice president and didn't know what was going on there. He had to be told only when he became president that there was such a thing as the project to develop an atom bomb. This extraordinary secrecy was unconstitutional, as a lot of war measures are. But in earlier wars, for instance, the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, or World War II when Franklin Roosevelt detained Japanese Americans. It was recognized that that was a suspension of the Constitution, and it was rectified later. In both cases, the Supreme Court said it had been unconstitutional. But all of the measures that they took at Los Alamos were never declared unconstitutional. In fact, they were adopted. As Groves had been the autocratic director there, the president became the sole unchecked authority over the use of the atomic bomb for military purposes. Congress had no say in the matter. The setting up of the CIA, the NSC, the NSA, all of these things were meant to keep the great secret that we had, the atomic bomb, to keep it from the Russians, to develop it, to develop the hydrogen bomb, to set up deployment areas around the world. Originally, there was the Strategic Air Command to keep planes in the air around the clock every day, 24 hours a day, carrying bombs in case we had to drop them on somebody. Then, of course, we developed atomic submarines and satellites. And all of this immense national security apparatus grew out of the Manhattan Project and took it as its model.
So you're saying that every layer of, like, nuclear policy and nuclear war policy added more layers of secrecy, that initially the secrecy around the Manhattan Project was so that the Germans and Japanese wouldn't find out we were making the bomb. Then there was secrecy so that the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't find out how to make a bomb. Then there was secrecy so nobody would know where the bombs were being hidden. Or is that what you're saying, that every development required more secrecy?
That's right. And then there was the policing of the Americans themselves, the loyalty programs, the classification of secrets, the security clearance process. So what was a secrecy at Hanford and Oak Ridge and Los Alamos became a secrecy for the whole United States. That was the kind of discipline that worked for the atomic bomb. And because it worked, they thought, well, this is the way we have to keep doing it. And so none of those things were declared unconstitutional. As I say, the Congress had no oversight. It didn't authorize the funds. In fact, Leslie Groves was outside the military chain of command. He dropped the bombs without authorization from his military superiors. The people who had appointed him were a special little group that the president had set up. And when he thought, well, I might be sick, have a heart attack, be attacked, be killed, he appointed his successor secretly. Again, it was not part of any constitutional procedure at all. It was an extraordinary departure. And because it worked, it became not only a model but an ideal, so that from then on, to have clearance to get to secrets became the source of power in our government.
So you think that the whole idea of commander-in-chief has been greatly expanded since the president became the person who had the authority to launch a nuclear attack and the code
Yes.
to do it with. And you also think that President Bush kind of expanded that idea of commander-in-chief. In what way?
Well, he inherited a process that began under President Reagan. In President Reagan's attorney general office, there was the Office of Legal Counsel, which came up with the idea of the unitary executive. And that became a favorite cause of the Federalist Society and of various people who have become Supreme Court justices.
And the Federalist Society is a group of conservative lawyers.
Yes. And Edwin Meese's Justice Department had a number of young people who wanted to support President Reagan's defense of deregulation of the agencies. And up to that time, when Congress set up an agency, it said that it had the right to oversee the performance of that agency, as it oversees the executive power in general, because after all, it has the right to impeach any member of the executive. And it can't do that unless it can find out what that group is doing. Well, these people said at the outset that no, once you set up the agency, it's totally under the control of the president, and his power over it is unitary. That is, he has the right not only to administer these things, but to decide whether anybody can interfere with them. Now that's been expanded to the dismay of some of the original people who set up this idea. And it's now said that the president, under George Bush, has the power not only to administer the agencies, but to administer the whole defense apparatus. And not only to administer it, but to initiate war on his own authority.
Now, President George W. Bush did get a vote from Congress before the Iraq War.
That's right. But in other cases, he did not. Every war that has been started has not been a declaration of war. He got some kind of approval, but not a declaration of war. And that's been, again, a repeated pattern since World War II. None of that happened before World War II. What happened at the end of World War II is that emergency measures, secrecy, classification, all those things that had come in during war were extended. So we went direct from World War II into the Cold War. And then we went direct from the Cold War into the War on Terror. And so as Senator Moynihan said, we should have had declassification at the end of all these emergencies. Instead, we've had an increase. The number of classified documents, the number of clearance requirements, the number of loyalty investigations, all of these things have mounted and mounted and mounted over the last 60 years.
We did have several years between the Cold War and 9/11.
We didn't have any suspension of the security apparatus. Once that national security apparatus got into place, it's never been cut back. The budget of the CIA, of the NSA, of the NSC has grown, and its activities, especially covert activities, have grown continuously.
Now, in talking about the powers of the president to go to war, in 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution. And that was supposed to make sure that Congress had a vote in whether or not to go to war. Can you explain what the War Powers Resolution was in 1973?
Yes. The Constitution says Congress alone has the power to declare war. Well, the presidents had ignored that so long that Congress wanted to edge back into the act. So it didn't assert its true constitutional power. Wait a minute, only we can declare war. It said, all right, if you want to go to war, Mr. President, you have to tell us so and give us a time span in which to approve, and we will either approve or disapprove, and then you will have to withdraw. But every president since that passed has ignored that War Powers Act, which was itself unconstitutional because it ceded a power that it was not in the authority of the Congress to cede. It can't say, well, we'll have a shared power of declaring war. The Constitution doesn't say that you have a shared power. It says you have all the power to declare war.
So in a way, the War Powers Resolution, which looked like it was taking back power for Congress, actually gave up power by deciding
That's
to
right.
share that power with the president.
That's right. And it didn't even work. You know, they thought, well, but maybe if we try to split the pie, he'll pay attention to us. But they didn't.
Some of the secrets that you write about aren't so secret anymore. After all, you're writing about them. How secret could they be? But did you come upon any secrets that you think developed out of the early nuclear age that you were unaware of and that really surprised you?
Well, yes. One of the examples of, see, what happened after the war, World War II, is that they needed to have deployment areas. They needed to have friendly governments that would allow us to base our planes originally and then our submarines, our listening posts for radiation, for other things of that sort. And so we had to set up friendly governments. or operate with friendly governments and make sure they stayed friendly, which meant sometimes we interfered in their electoral process. But I had not really known until I started looking at this about Diego Garcia, an island in the Pacific, in the Indian Ocean. They wanted to have a place strategically close to the Middle East where they could have an entire base for submarines and airplanes and supply, et cetera, with no interference by a local government. So they took over what had previously been a British protectorate and extruded the natives, thousands of natives, just kicked them out, as we had done, by the way, in the islands in the Pacific where we tested the atomic and hydrogen bombs. It's entirely secret. Journalists are never allowed there. It's a huge staging area. It's been used in the Tonkin Gulf and the Iraq War and others. And the people, the natives who were kicked out, have asked that they come back, and they're not allowed. The purchasing of the materials for it was kept from Congress. The treaty that they set up with Britain to take over the island, it's still technically a British protectorate, but they gave us total control over what goes on there, was not public for a long, 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 long time. And what goes on now is still secret. Now, we don't know how many of those there are around the world.
Have you thought about what it must be like for somebody who's elected president to not only inherit, you know, what we think of as the powers of the office, but to also inherit this secret world, this hidden world of powers and of military bases and secrets and just all of the stuff that you've been describing?
Yes, I have. And a good example of that, it seems to me, is the reaction of President Obama when he took office. Before that, he had said, oh, well, I won't do these things. I won't torture. I won't have renditions of people captured on foreign territory. I'll close Guantanamo. I won't do signing statements in which I declare what Congress passed something that I won't obey. And right away, he started saying, his people started saying, we'll have to consider renditions. We'll have to continue signing statements. We'll have to consider a slower closing down of Guantanamo, et cetera. And I think that's what he gets. He gets a military and intelligence apparatus of immense extent. And they say to him, don't destroy our morale. Don't undercut what we've had so much trouble building up. You need us. We need you. So play along. And that's what the president has been doing.
You are concerned that we've built a nation that is so entrenched in the secrecy that came along with the development of nuclear weapons and that just kept getting expanded as the nuclear arsenal got expanded. Do you think there's any turning back? You know, you've pointed out that it used to be when we reverted from wartime to peacetime that all, like, the wartime powers would be put aside and we'd return to peacetime. But there's always something now. It's the Cold War. It's the War on Terror. And secrecy keeps expanding. It never seems to shrink. So do you think there's any turning back?
It would be very difficult. For one thing, consider all of the classified material. To declassify that is immensely time-consuming and expensive. So it's not going to happen. It just keeps growing and growing, as Senator Moynihan said. And the costs of secrecy are great. They cover up our crimes, our errors. Moynihan said, for instance, when the Bay of Pigs occurred, President Kennedy was not listening to academic experts on Cuba or foundations or open polls, which would have told him that Fidel Castro is immensely popular. You were not going to incite a rebellion against him at that stage of the game. And Moynihan says he didn't listen to any of those things because none of them were classified. He listened to people who all had this great secret knowledge that nobody else had. And that's what made him commit this error. And he said that happens all the time with secrecy. We listen to the people with a stake because they're supposed to be the priesthood of the secrets. And you cut off the sources of knowledge that would criticize this inner elite, that would make things more open and correctable.
Well, Gary Wills, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Gary Wills is the author of the new book, Bomb Power. While broadcast TV has spent lots of energy and money reconfiguring its late-night roster, cable TV is proceeding as usual, churning out shows in prime time that are welcome alternatives to what the major networks have to offer. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, notes the return of a couple of such shows tonight.
So far in the year 2010, there hasn't been a better, more compelling serialized drama on TV than the Jay versus Conan battle. But that ended Friday. And ended, for the record, with a farewell show from Conan O'Brien that was classy in its restraint and in his gratitude to NBC for giving him his career in the first place. But that was Friday. Now it's Monday. So now what? On commercial TV, we have one sizzling offering. The fifth hour of 24 on Fox, with Jack Bauer getting involved in a New York assassination plot. On PBS, on American Experience, we have a really interesting biography of Wyatt Earp, one that goes far beyond the usual portrayal of the Western lawman in popular movies. But unless you turn to cable, that's about it. On cable, though, the joint is jumping. The best cable series returning tonight, beginning its third season, is Damages, the intelligently crafted legal series from the FX network. It stars Glenn Close as super lawyer Patty Hughes, a woman who is as successful as she is ruthless. Like Tony Soprano, she's both the hero and villain of her own series. And Close, in this role, is just great. She acts with such range and such subtlety. It's the best and most nuanced performance by a female lead since Helen Mirren starred in Prime Suspect. And Close, in Damages, is keeping some fast company and giving them chances to shine just as brightly. In season one, her main antagonist was played by Ted Danson, in a role that forever shattered his stereotype as the affable bartender Sam Malone on Cheers. The second year, Close played opposite William Hurt, her old co-star from The Big Chill. And this year on Damages, the recurring players include Keith Carradine, who's made a new career of playing great supporting roles in such shows as Deadwood and Dexter. And also new to the series are Lily Tomlin and Martin Short, who, like Ted Danson, play it straight and play it beautifully. The primary plot this year has Patty Hughes prosecuting Louis Tobin, a man accused of a Bernie Madoff-style Ponzi scheme. Here's a scene in which Glenn Close, as Patty, is conducting a deposition. The Tobin family lawyer, played by Martin Short, is there. And answering Patty's questions is Tobin's wife, played by Lily Tomlin, played very nicely and very icily.
And that's when he told us about the fraud.
That it was a Ponzi scheme.
Yes. He said the business was all a lie. The investments weren't real. He said he couldn't hide it anymore.
Your son Joe contacted the district attorney the next morning. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Did that make you angry?
What my son does is his own business.
Joe worked for your husband. Do you think he knew about the scheme?
Objection calls for speculation. Mrs. Tobin can't be expected to guess what's in her son's head.
You're going to depose Joe? Ask him.
Mrs. Tobin, you say that you knew nothing about your husband's fraud.
Yes.
You shared your life with him for over 40 years, and yet you didn't know that he was stealing.
Actually, I'm so sorry. Darling, can you get me an Earl Grey, no sugar, dash of skim?
She may ask for skim, but Damages is the cream of the crop. Finally, there's a new season of Tracy Ullman's State of the Union, in which the amazing Ullman, half-comedian, half-chameleon, burns through about a dozen outlandish caricatures or impressions in each show. In this year's opener, in the makeup room for a TV talk show, she impersonates not only Rachel Maddow, but Arianna Huffington, Barney Frank, and several others, all at the same time, courtesy of clever editing and special effects. The problem, though, is that the techniques and the makeup are so distracting, the comedy itself is kind of diluted. I feel like I should be laughing more, especially since Ullman's talents are so impressive. But as with Damages, Ullman's series is another welcome mid-season return and another watchable alternative to what the broadcast networks aren't offering these days.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film at Rowan University. His new book is called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.